In terms of the unique character of China-Japan relations, I think, Daqing, you've done more comparative political study, history study than I have. I don't really feel confident. I do feel that in Asia, in East Asia, China, Japan, Korea have been kind of the three centers of learning and politics and military power. And that China being the big land power and Japan the small power, the nature of Buddhism, Confucianism, and written characters make it somewhat unique, but perhaps you could give more things about it, because you've worked now with some Europeans on that, and say, how's that different, say, than Germany and Russia, or say Germany and the United States, or I'd be welcome your thoughts on those issues. Thank you.
Okay, well, we have some time left, so I want to have an opportunity, give you an opportunity to ask questions. So anybody would like to start, don't be shy. Okay, so we'll take the two. If you can introduce yourself and then ask the question. Okay.
Hi, my name is Zhong Tianhan. I'm a PhD candidate in the History Department at George Washington University. I also want to express my gratitude to Professor Vogel, because the Military History Conference you helped to organize is one of the illuminating lights for me to do history of the Sino-Japanese War. So thank you. My question is about Japan's relationship with Taiwan. I think maybe it followed a very unique trajectory in the 20th century. And my question is, to what extent do you think Japan's relationship with Taiwan could be integrated into the big picture of the China-Japan relations? Thank you.
Here I am free. I get a little professorial. It's hard to explain in 1 minute. I got 4 or 5 minutes maybe. Japan won the 1895 war, it took over Taiwan and became its colony. And if you compare what I think is the three colonial periods, Taiwan, Korea, and Manchuria, the one with Taiwan, I think, became a better relationship. It started out in a very tough manner. The Japanese general Nogi, who had fought in the war, went up and down through Taiwan and knocked out all the opposition. Killed a lot of people, it was very tough. But after that time, Taiwan did not have, unlike Korea, did not have a centralized government or tradition or symbolic system so they could unite against the Japanese. It was a relatively undeveloped area. And it almost became as if that were a part of Japan. Some people compared it to England's invasion of Ireland, maybe, and becoming part of the British Isles, and almost incorporated within. And the Taiwanese school system was set up by Japan. And Japan was trying at the time to prove that they were a modern country, and they wanted to have a civilized administration of their colonies, and they wanted to do more for the modernization than, say, the Europeans had done in India or Africa. And they therefore pushed a lot more in education. Education grew much more rapidly. And the person they put in charge of Taiwan before long, Koto Shimpei, had been trained first in Germany, but then public health. And it was at a time when the United States was working on yellow fever and malaria and so forth in Central America and other places. And so the Japanese were able to say around 1900, look what benefit we're bringing to Taiwan, because we are controlling those diseases and providing better life, better health, and more modernization. And that because there had been so little resistance, it was almost as if they had been incorporated and become part Japanese. It doesn't mean that Taiwanese always loved the Japanese. They may have been outsiders. But when the Kuomintang came in, established after 1949, and particularly when they established martial law and the Arba, the incident where the mainland soldiers had killed so many local people, the local feelings against the mainland and the Kuomintang was so powerful that at that point, many Chinese said that the Japanese weren't nearly that bad. And so a lot of the Taiwanese people felt closer to Japan, and by displaying their love for Japan was a way of thumbing their nose at the Kuomintang. And of course, as Japan became a more modern industrial power, they looked to other places for cheaper labor. They moved to Taiwan and Korea, which were nearby former colonies, and where there were a lot of people who spoke Japanese, and it was very easy for them. And when Taiwan developed a freer voting system, Lee Teng-hui comes into power, and he was Japan educated. I went with an American delegation to meet President Lee Teng-hui one time, and my Taiwanese host knew that I knew Japanese. They say, "Olga, why don't you start the conversation in Japanese and get him in good mood? And then we can have a real discussion." So I did it, and it worked. So he spoke Japanese better than he spoke Chinese. I mean, he was coming to grow up as a kid in a Japanese colony. That was the president of Taiwan. So you can imagine the mainland leaders looking at that deeper relationship between Japan and Taiwan. They're very unhappy with Japan's deeper connections. Of course, over the years, that's attenuated. The younger people, there are not that many people in Taiwan who know Japanese in the same way as those early years. But still, the input of Japanese culture and popular culture and so forth, it's still a pretty good relationship from the Japanese-Taiwan relationship. That means that the people of the mainland are very unhappy with that linkage. That's a long-winded way, but I think to understand that context, all those parts are necessary. Yeah.
My name is Kazu Koyama. I'm an alumnus of GW from a while ago, actually. Actually, I was here for your last book's rollout in 2011, so that's
wow. Thank you.
Yes, but I guess I made it back to DC on time for this book. My question to you is, maybe you alluded to this already, but how do you, what is your prediction about Sino-Japanese relations? Where is it headed? Do you think Prime Minister Abe has said that there is a new age of Sino-Japanese relations is upon us? However, Japan is very deeply committed to the U.S. Japan Security Alliance as well. Do you think that this new age will blossom, or do you think maybe it's doomed to fail because of Japan's alliance with the U.S.?
I think if I were Japanese and looking at the size of the Chinese military, and I knew that my local population in Japan was very reluctant to spend more than 1% of GNP, maybe 1 point something, but not too much, on defense, I know in the long run that Japan could be a little like a porcupine, that if you try to get close to it, you may, but it could not really deal with China. And therefore, they would want to keep a military alliance with the United States. I don't see that changing. However, I think now that this big change has occurred, that China is now the larger power, and with an economy now that's maybe twice as large as Japanese economy, that there is a basis for a new, steadier relationship. I think the Japanese feel that if necessary, the Chinese might go back and get patriotic education by becoming anti-Japanese. Then that could happen again. And the Japanese are very concerned that by the Chinese keeping the pressure on what Chinese call the Diaoyu Islands and the Japanese call Senkaku, that they could increase that pressure And I think the Chinese are keeping their pressure just enough. But having said all that, I think that there is a good chance now that the relationship will stabilize and maybe get a little better, with Japan being a little more independent from the United States. I think the American decision to get out of TPP has to make Japanese wonder how much they can rely on the United States in trade issues and whether they shouldn't take initiative. And I think China right now, seeing American investment going down a little, feels that they can get more investment from Japan. And I think from Xi Jinping's point of view, if some Chinese feel he hasn't managed the relationship with America, has kind of fouled it up, that next spring, when he said in cherry blossom time he'll go to Japan after the NPC meeting in spring, perhaps late April, May, if he goes to Japan, that there may be a significant increase in Japanese investment in China. And the Chinese have already begun to feel a little more comfortable with Japan. Several years ago, when almost 90% disliked Japan, it's gone down 20-30%. And when Chinese visitors go to Japan, this place isn't so bad. I mean, the people are polite, the place is orderly, it's clean. I'd like to go back there. And the tourists from China to Japan has gone up increasingly every year, significantly. And this year probably it could hit 10 million. And next year it could be even more than that, especially with the Olympics and Xi Jinping visit and so forth. So I think there is likely to be a somewhat improvement in Sino-Japanese relations, and the Chinese will try to pull the tie between the United States and Japan a little looser. And from the Chinese point of view, we'd like to weaken American military power in the region. If they can create a little more doubts about the depth of military ties between Japan and the United States, that would be, from the Chinese point of view, probably a good thing. So I think what we're likely to see over the next year, you can never be sure there could be some striking changes that interfere, but I think without any huge unexpected something or other, I think the trend will be this year for stabilization relations, slight improvement in Chinese-Japanese relations.
Any other questions?
Hi, my name is Cassie Charles. I'm a first-year Asian Studies Master's student here at the LA School. Thank you so much, Professor Vogel, for your lecture. I had a question that sort of ties into that about the Western role in history in this situation, because we've seen between Japan and Korea how, even though relationships can start to get better over time, that the historical disputes can still flare up and cause immense disasters, looking at the trade war right now. So I wanted to ask you, do you think that the West, or countries that stand between China and Japan, much like you yourself as a scholar, do you think that they have a role to sort of be keepers of history against purposeful erasure of history, sort of like how in Japan it's not really talked about what goes on during World War II, or in China where we know that history is very much censored. So do you think that the West has a role in making sure that the countries sort of don't forget it and are able to overcome it to have better relationships in the future?
I think the role of the West has changed quite a bit. In the 19th century, after all, a lot of the efforts in modernization came from Western ships going to China and to Japan. We opened Commodore Perry, forced Japan open, and then the British, the Opium War opened, and then the French, the Arrow War, pushing China to open. And from the point of view of Japan in the late 19th century, part of the question was whether to link with the West and or whether to be the leader of Asia in resisting the West. And I think there was very considerable appeal already in the late 19th century. And in the time of World War II, the Japanese talked about the co-prosperity treaty. What they meant by that was that Japan would provide economic kind of parental guidance and help to other Asia countries, that they would be the lead and it's against the West. Then immediately after World War II, Japan links up with the United States. China, you know, which had been America's ally in the World War II, then the Korean War becomes America's enemy. So there have been such fundamental changes. Then, of course, China was linked with Russia against the United States. And then after 1971-72, it became China cooperating with the United States and Japan against Russia. And after the collapse of the Soviet Union, well, already earlier, but after the collapse of the Soviet Union, then the alliance between China and the United States became somewhat looser, in the same way with Japan. So there have been a lot of twists and turns, but I think if I had to give one overall answer, it's the West will not be so powerful as it had been in the past, because the relative power of China is much greater than it was before. So I think the dominance that the United States had in the late 20th century and the dominance the European powers had late 19th and earlier 20th century is gone. You know, the Asian countries, the industry has spread, the military capacities have spread, science and technology has spread to Asia. And therefore, I think the role of the outside powers cannot be as great. The impact cannot be as great. There may be linkages. I think that the idea you hear from some of the Trump people about decoupling is impossible. You know, and that's also another, and the ideas you hear about China, that they can control information inside China and present certain face, that's ridiculous. It's impossible. When you have 1.5 million Chinese studying abroad, how can the Chinese control the information going to the Chinese people? There's just no way. And almost 100 million Chinese visits abroad every year. How can you, you know, World War II, Japan roughly closed, they could have pretty much control over information. China in an earlier closed period could, but there's no way that's going to happen again. The world has changed. And so I think it's going to be a more complex period, but that the European countries will not play as great a role as before.
Can I ask a follow-up question?
So you can also tell.
Moving from the level of power politics to the specifically history and the role of Western academics like you, so this goes back also to my earlier question. For example, in the current Japan-Korea friction, would you suggest another trilateral history conferences as you personally organize between Japan, China, and then Western historians? So that was also my question earlier. Can you reflect on the benefit as well as the limitation of Western sort of mediating specifically on these history issues?
You know, times and contexts are constantly change, but I think at the time 2000, when you had this organized effort of Chinese and Japanese historians to meet, my understanding is they each stated what they believed, but there really wasn't kind of cooperation. And I think, as I understand, Kitaoko, who led the Japanese side, ended up pretty disappointed that it didn't go very far. I think there is an advantage of having a Western scholar do it, because it doesn't have quite the underlying gut problems of national history. I mean, we aren't involved in Japan. I don't feel as deeply involved as a partisan in Japanese or Chinese history. And so at a time of those tensions, I think there is a role that Western scholars can play in helping sponsor these things, and Western universities can provide a location for more detached cooperative learning where nationalist passions can be better under control by people who are saying, trying to look at history together. I think the same thing is true of European, as a non, in an age of great patriotism and nationalism, when looking at a country's history can have so many implications that the role of an outsider can be very useful in providing a locus where you can have more detached, unemotional efforts to get at the truth. Maybe that's trying to give the Western people too big a role, but I really believe that.
Well, I think we've come to the end of the time period, and I think you've given us a suggestion of a project that we can have here.
And I think that's a great place to do it.
Yes, to have a trilateral discussion between Japan and Korea on the history issue. But Ezra, thank you so much for coming to GW and giving us so much to think about. We hope you can come back again very soon. So please join me in thanking Professor Vogel and thank you, Professor Young and Richard, for organizing this. Ezra has kindly offered to sign any copies of your book, so you can come up, and we have to vacate in, what, about 30 minutes? Yeah. Oh, yes, and please fill out a survey. This is a duty of being the East Asia National Resource Center, so if you can fill this out, that would be great. Thank you very much for coming.